Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's the Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Ben.
Wayne Moyer is with us as well, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, joining us by phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben.
Wonderful to have you with us, Rachel and Wayne, as well as our listeners to join us on all the landscapes just come flip over into a new landscape, it seems, as we do week to week on Wednesday, Politics Wednesdays. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. We're going to be talking a little bit later about Attorney General Sessions being questioned in the Russia investigation. We learned that this week. His interview took place last week. Also, we heard in the top of the hour news some GOP's lawmakers are suspicious of the FBI. Also, Vice President Pence in Israel, and that much-awaited visit to Davos, Switzerland, and the World Economic Forum by President Trump. That's on our docket for a little bit later. But first of all, let's talk about what happened over the weekend. The government shutdown lasted for 3 days. What did it accomplish? What's the way forward on immigration? Those are questions for Rachel and Wayne in just a moment. But let's hear from the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, in the Senate. If you remember from our news, the Democrats did not get what they wanted, which was a DACA solution. But they did get a commitment from Senator McConnell to debate and discuss immigration. Here's what he had to say.
So long as the government remains open, it would be my intention to take up legislation here in the Senate that would address DACA, border security, and related issues, as well as disaster relief, defense funding, health care, and other important matters. Let me be clear. This immigration debate will have a level playing field at the outset and an amendment process that is fair to all sides. This immigration debate will have a level playing field at the outset and an amendment process that's fair to all sides. And it would be my strong preference for the Senate to consider a proposal that can actually be signed into law. A bipartisan, bicameral group is already negotiating, and I look forward to completion of its work.
Okay, Mitch McConnell there. Listeners, how do you view the shutdown that lasted over the weekend and its aftermath? Republicans, Democrats, independents, weigh in on this. 1-866-780-9100. Rachel, you weigh in on this first. What was accomplished, if anything?
I think it's hard to say exactly. I think, quite frankly, the Democrats overplayed their hand on this one. They had hoped to pressure Republican lawmakers into an immigration deal. The Republicans seem to not know exactly what sort of deal would be signed by the president, and they seem unwilling to move forward with that. And many of them made the argument that, you know, they don't want to be held hostage with a budget shutdown simply because, you know, we have some time to negotiate on the DACA recipients and what will happen to them. And so in the end, this, you know, agreement or commitment to have a fair and open debate in the U.S. Senate, progressive groups feel like it doesn't go nearly far enough. And they blame Chuck Schumer. Conservative Democrats are saying, you know, it's a step, but we have no idea where it goes from here. Why did we have to shut down the government? It's unclear that either party right now has a cohesive message about what this shutdown actually accomplished.
The greatest disappointment in the Democratic Party from the progressives, a number of them with 20 20 tattooed on their head, so to speak. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, also Senator Harris of California. Wayne Moyer, what do you think of this promise, this deal that Mitch McConnell made with the minority leader Schumer to debate this? Do you think we're going to be seeing at long last something happen in terms of more comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, I think before the agreement, it wasn't clear that McConnell was even going to bring immigration up in the Senate. And I think now he's publicly committed to bringing immigration up. Now, that does not mean that there will actually be any immigration action, even on the Dreamers. And we know there's substantial opposition to action in the House of Representatives. So what I see is a small step forward, at least in getting the Senate to debate.
Mm-hmm. Rachel said it was an overplayed hand. Do you agree on the part of the Democrats, Wayne? Overplayed, miscalculated?
I don't. I don't see either side as having gained very much in this. I think this is just a small hiccup. And I don't have a sense that it's going to make much difference in the election.
Right. Rachel, I mean, this shutdown, at the pace of our news developments, whoever gets the blame, if there is any blame assigned, will be long forgotten before November, won't it, Rachel?
Yeah, I suspect that that's exactly the case. You know, we have leaders in the Senate, particularly progressive leaders, as you noted, particularly those who seem to be likely contenders in 2020, who are disappointed with where we are right now. They wanted to see an immigration deal come forward. And then, you know, we have those who are up for reelection in the states that Trump won among the Democrats who are saying, you know, I don't know why we had to do this. We didn't have to do this. We could have kept the government open. So, you know, by the time the 2018 midterm elections come along, I don't think this will be top of mind. Having said that, over the next 3 weeks, there will be extensive efforts to try to reach some sort of agreement on immigration. And those efforts ultimately, if they prove fruitful and some sort of immigration policy is passed, that policy certainly then could play a role in, you know, voting considerations for the 2018 midterms.
Rachel, you referenced this a moment ago. It's almost like, I think you were going in this direction, it's almost like we have three parties there. Well, three variables, the Republicans, the Democrats, and their degree of whether they're unified or not. But then we have, let's just say, a wild card in our mm-hmm. our president, right? We go back to late last week, the meeting, Chuck Schumer meeting with the president at the White House. That didn't come out to anything. Now we have the fallout from that on Monday. The Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer from New York, suggesting that President Trump missed an opportunity to make his signature campaign issue a reality, saying that Chuck Schumer put the border wall on the table.
President Trump turned away from not one, but two bipartisan compromises. Each would have averted this shutdown. Each would have led to a deal on the budget and health care and disaster aid and things like opioids and veterans and pensions and on immigration. My recent offer to the president was a generous one. I put his signature campaign issue on the table in exchange for DACA, and still, he turned away. President Trump's unwillingness to compromise caused the Trump shutdown and brought us to this moment. The facts are well known.
Of course, the president was not going to leave that without a response. Late last night, he reiterated that funding for his promised wall along the U.S.-Mexican border remains a requirement for any deal to shield undocumented immigrants brought here as children from deportation. His tweet, "Crying Chuck Schumer fully understands, especially after his humiliating defeat, that if there is no wall, there is no DACA." There, Wayne Moyer. So we have this at times that they've seemed close, and now drummed up a renewed animosity between the minority leader, head of the Democrats, and President Trump.
Well, yes, that's true. My sense is that eventually what's going to happen is the DACA, there will be a DACA agreement in Congress, and there will also be substantial Democratic support for better border security with Mexico. And so I look at all this as just part of the overall bargaining. The trade-off is clear as what will have to be made. Funding for the wall in return, or for some kind of border security in return for the Dreamers.
Right. And Rachel, jump in on that. Wayne intentionally, of course, said better border security, didn't say the wall, because there's a debate whether what a wall is the answer here, is providing the best security.
Yeah, this is an ongoing debate among both Republicans and between the Republicans and the Democrats. You know, President Trump obviously during the campaign made the wall a big deal. And there, I think there's a symbolic and rhetorical power to a wall, the notion of this actual structure at the border. But, you know, most people who study immigration would tell you that a physical wall is not likely to fundamentally alter the state of immigration in the country, and that there are much better ways to spend money in immigration policy if we want to secure our border, if we want to address the problem of undocumented immigrants in the country. So this is something that, you know, the wall has become kind of a rhetorical device to refer to a lot of different things, all of which you can kind of generalize under border security.
Right. But also with the wall, in tandem with the wall was mentioned that Mexico would be paying for it. Now, that's long since ceased to be part of the conversation, Rachel.
Yes, long since ceased to be part of the conversation. and funding for this wall or for increased border security, you know, an original deal that seemed to be going somewhere, it appropriated some money, but not very much, a few billion dollars, which to us seems like a lot of money, but in government terms is not.
Or if you're in Davos, perhaps.
Right, exactly. And then you had this figure of potentially $18 billion, and Schumer's proposals and negotiations with the president seemed to bring it up to $25. So, you know, exactly how much money we're talking about is also an issue of debate here.
Okay. How do you view the shutdown? What are your thoughts on the future of immigration? Is this an opportunity, perhaps, with the minority leader's promise? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Reggie, I hope you're still on the line from Oskaloosa. Hi, Reggie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. One thing I wanted to bring up is Obama himself, when he was president, in more than a dozen public appearances, said that he did not have the constitutional authority to unilaterally act on immigration, yet he did write the executive order for DACA. So what he did was unconstitutional, and giving Congress 6 months to fix it was very generous.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe the shutdown, the Democrats wanted the shutdown because they always get to blame the Republicans, and they were looking for a campaign issue coming in the fall. And when it backfired, that's why the shutdown only lasted for a couple of days instead of a couple of weeks.
Okay. Reggie, thanks for your view from Oskaloosa. Reggie dialed 1-866-780-9100. What about that? We had this. It's an executive order. Donald Trump said you have until, what is it, March, Wayne, to find a congressional solution, which would be a much better solution, right, than an executive order, not as fragile, right?
No, I think a legislative solution is the right thing to do, and I hope that Congress is able to come up with one.
Let me get you a reaction to this. This is a quote from Politico on the issue of the shutdown, and perhaps deeper than who won in this latest tactical battle. Quoting Politico, the deeper issue is what this brief and soon forgotten episode says about the broken legislative practices inside the halls of Congress. From immigration to health care, privacy to national security, there are bipartisan majorities on Capitol Hill willing to debate any number of important bills. The problem is they aren't getting a say in what Congress debates. Congressional leaders care more about spin than deliberation. As a result, Congress has morphed from a Democratic arena weighing important policy differences to a debate-stunted PR firm. This is not exactly new, but the 115th Congress is reaching new levels of dysfunction, and as long as leaders seek brinksmanship over debate, shutdowns will only become more common. Rachel, would you agree with that?
I would agree with portions of that. The institutional design of Congress has always thwarted action. It's designed to do that. It's designed to make it exceptionally hard to get anything done. And, you know, if you look at it from that perspective, it does a very good job.
Yes. And
since successful.
Since 1976, 19 shutdowns, according to the Washington Post article I was reading. And Wayne, why don't other countries have this problem, or are they just not reported in our news? I have to believe they would be reported if they were.
I think there are two things operating. First of all, there are not very many government shutdowns elsewhere. Two things operating in the United States that don't operate in other countries. One, we have the filibuster in the Senate, which means that you will need some minority support to get any kind of budget legislation through. And that provides the opportunity for a minority to shut the government down. I don't know of any other country that has a filibuster. The second thing that's operating is that in most countries, the operation of the bureaucracy is totally separated from the political process. So if the government doesn't get a budget through, the bureaucracy continues to operate under the previous budget. Now, the one exception that I know about is there was once a shutdown in Australia, and the Governor General of Australia, the appointee of the king, kicked the whole government out, including the Prime Minister. And unfortunately, since the American Revolution, we don't have any governor general in this country who can kick out the Congress or can kick out the president.
It's interesting also, Wayne, we've become so used to these shutdowns, or perhaps has the world become so used to them? You would think if you hear a country not funding its government that it was, I'll just say the word, teetering, or that at least would be in financial peril. And, you know, if you look at the stock market, if you look at other economic indicators, the world just says, okay, that's the U.S., that's America being America, huh?
Well, I think there's an element to that, but I don't think it creates a very good impression overseas that that we allow our government to shut down. The United States is strong. We can get away with it. A weaker government, I think it would be much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming up to a break in a few minutes. Rachel, tell us the way forward. What are your thoughts on immigration as we consider the next, I guess we have about 15 days now before the end of this CR, this continuing resolution that headed off this, after 3 days, got the government back. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, we have this bipartisan group of senators that are working right now to try to craft some sort of agreement. I don't think we're going to see a lot of action in the Senate on immigration until about 2 days before the next shutdown vote. That tends to be how they operate these days. Finding agreement is going to be exceptionally difficult. Chuck Schumer very famously said on the floor on Friday night that negotiating with the president is like negotiating with Jell-O. So one of the things that I think particularly Republicans are seeking over the next 2 weeks is to figure out more about what is acceptable to the White House, what sorts of compromises can be reached here. And the big question then becomes whether or not any deal that's crafted in the Senate could possibly pass the House. And on the issue of DACA, there is majority support in the House of Representatives to provide some sort of pathway to citizenship for these individuals. But Speaker Ryan has very clearly adopted what we call the Hastert rule, which is not to bring anything up on the floor unless it has a majority of the majority support. So in other words, unless a majority of Republicans support a proposal, he wouldn't bring it to the floor. And right now it doesn't look like something that might pass the Senate could gain support among a majority of Republicans in the House. So then the ball goes to Paul Ryan's court to figure out whether or not he could get something through the House.
Mm-hmm. We have Yeah, go ahead. You wanted to add something? No.
No. That's
Okay. Let me get Wayne's comment. We have a couple minutes here. We want to cover a number of other issues in the second half, but let me get your take on North Korea with the Winter Olympics in South Korea coming up next month. We've seen some developments there, some less aggressive rhetoric, the lessening of tension, Wayne, and some overtures between the South and the North, right?
Yeah, I think this is really going to be a fascinating thing to watch. We have North Korea sending some of its athletes, I think 22 of them, to join the South Korean team. So there'll be a united Korean team. They'll be marching in together. The women's field hockey team has both women from North Korea and South Korea on it. And it'll be fascinating to see how this actually operates.
How did this come about?
Well, I think North Korea offered to take an initiative on this, and the government of South Korea, which wants to conciliate with North Korea, it's a more liberal leftist government in South Korea, sort of picked up on the offer. One thing has led to another. But, of course, at the same time, behind the scenes, North Korea is still developing its nuclear capability. And in some ways, one can see what North Korea is doing as a way to pull South Korea away from the United States and create tensions between the U.S. and South Korea.
Right. Yeah. So what does this do to this administration's, let's just say turning up the heat with rhetoric and so forth on North Korea? What does it do to this administration's foreign policy towards North America that North Korea has made these overtures and there's a warming up with the South?
I think it's going to make things difficult. I think what the administration is probably going to try to do is sort of tone things down for a little while, assuming that after the Olympics are over, North Korea will be just as belligerent as ever. And so the U.S., on one hand, wants to try to keep its very close relations with South Korea, but it's... I think it will still keep its antagonism toward North Korea and still be as concerned as it is now with North Korea's nuclear development.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, stay with us. Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. This is Politics Wednesday on River to River. When we come back, we'll talk about new developments that have come to light this week in the Russia investigation. Also, some suspicions by some in the GOP of the FBI, and we'll go into that a little bit. Vice President Pence in Israel, and of course Davos awaiting Trump's arrival. Will his message be globalist, protectionist, populist? We'll see which ist it will be when we come back. With Rachel Caulfield and Wayne Moyer, I'm Ben Kiefer, River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, our political scientists on board this week, our weekly look at the political landscape. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Well, Wayne, Rachel, we learned this week that the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, was the first member of Donald Trump's cabinet to be interviewed in the special counsel's investigation into Russian election meddling. We learned that it took place last week, that it lasted several hours, and reports interpreting this as Robert Mueller focusing on whether Donald Trump obstructed the investigation. We know that Mueller wants to question the president in the future at some point about the firing of FBI Director James Comey and about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, who spent some, 24 days, was it, in office. Rachel, What are your thoughts about these new facts coming to light? And we want to talk about the GOP's charges in just a moment, but let's keep to this facet of it, of the new developments for the moment.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that very clearly we're seeing now is we're seeing that Mueller's team is increasingly going for interviews with the people at the very top of the chain here. And Jeff Sessions is a big fish. And so, you know, typically this is an indication that the investigation is reaching its end point. So they've collected information from lower level staff, and now they're moving up into higher level staff. Jeff Sessions is particularly important because he led the foreign policy team during the campaign, and we know that one of the members of that team, Papadopoulos, has pleaded guilty at this point to lying to the FBI about contacts with the Russians. We know that during Jeff Sessions' confirmation hearing, he had indicated that he had no contact with anybody from Russia, when in fact he had met with the Russian ambassador. And we've heard reports that an aide for Jeff Sessions went to Capitol Hill and asked for dirt on James Comey. So there's kind of this cluster of issues surrounding Jeff Sessions that would indicate that he has relevant information, that he's been involved for a long time. And so, you know, we don't know, obviously, what that conversation with the Mueller investigation looked like last week, but I think we're nearing a final end point for this investigation.
Wayne Moyer, anything to add there?
Well, I agree with everything Rachel said. A couple of points. One, it's pretty clear that Mueller is focusing on obstruction of justice, and Sessions is a part who would clearly be an important person to interview on that score. And the other thing is that it seems to me, makes it very likely that Mueller will want to interview the president himself very soon.
Mm-hmm. When I recall Jeff Sessions' testimony before congressional committees, you will recall it as well. We heard a lot of "I don't recall" or "I cannot talk about that conversation, private conversation with the president." Wayne, are we likely – I mean, can you say that to when you have a special counsel investigating you? Can you say, I can't talk about what I discussed with the president?
He will be asked questions under oath, and I think he is required to answer those questions under oath.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, any idea there?
No, that's true. The only potential
because he was under oath before Congress as well,
right? The only potential circumstance under which he could potentially not share information under oath would be if he's exerting a claim of executive privilege, mm-hmm. and this is something that has come up with some other interviews with congressional committees. It is unclear whether or not there is any effort by Trump administration officials to claim executive privilege for any of these communications. A staffer typically does not get to claim executive privilege if the president is not claiming executive privilege.
And you know, executive privilege, perhaps you could explain that a little bit. Why do we have executive privilege? It's to protect the president and in order that the president can be informed and make the best decisions?
Yeah, particularly on national security issues. There are things that are held in confidence within the executive branch of government, particularly among our law enforcement agencies and our international diplomats and CIA agents, FBI agents, that are quite reasonably not for public consumption, for purposes of keeping the U.S. safe. And so, you know, the president then can claim executive privilege, which is basically saying, look, you know, I'm not willing to share this information because it pertains to national security. And if this information becomes public, it makes it impossible for me to do my job of keeping the U.S. safe.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the other developments this week with Robert Mueller, special counsel, now focusing on the president, it seems. Republicans have made some new charges of political bias, even charges of potential criminal misconduct in one of the nation's top law enforcement agencies, the FBI, missing text messages, a secret memo, the Nunes memo. I'm sorry, I think it's Nunes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Claiming to reveal an anti-Trump bias within the FBI. Also plans to recall Comey to testify about his handling of the 2016 investigation into Hillary Clinton. Let's listen to a little bit of Republican Representative Bob Goodlatte. He's from Virginia. This is in conversation with Fox News's Laura Ingraham, suggesting he is suspicious of the FBI when it comes to the conversation about text messages which have been selectively made public to lawmakers.
We should search every place to find them because I think they still exist in some form somewhere. I'm pleased that Attorney General Sessions has made a commitment to investigate this and find them, but we should also undertake whether there is some way to gather them from some other source. It is very important, but even the text messages we have are alarming, and the secret society just harks back to the text we saw before in December talking about the insurance policy. What has been going on in that five-month period of time? Well, we know one thing for sure, and that is that these people hostile to the president have not been conducting themselves in a manner that befits the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Wayne Moyer, what do you make of these very serious charges against our law enforcement?
Not a lot. Darryl Nunes had to, in fact, recuse himself from serving as the chairman of the House committee because of his own prejudices. He has put this document together. He's unwilling to release all of it, but release to the public, but release sections of it that are incriminating to the FBI. And so what really should happen is this thing should be thrown wide open to the public so people can investigate seriously what is actually in this memo.
Mm-hmm. Now, congressional Democrats are saying it's no accident that the GOP probes have escalated in this area as Robert Mueller has homed in, getting ever closer to Trump himself and his top allies, Representatives Adam Schiff of California, Democrat, of course, Elijah Cummings of Maryland, top Democrats, saying that these efforts smack of a partisan campaign to protect the president and discredit the investigators who have questioned his behavior. How do you interpret this, Rachel?
Well, I mean, I think Wayne is right in the sense that this is kind of a tangled web of partisan intent on all sides. And Devin Nunes has not been known for being transparent in his operations with the White House or with the committee that he used to lead. Having said that, you know, federal agencies are frequently in a position where if they act in a nonpartisan manner, the way they're supposed to act, they will inevitably run into political conflict. And the FBI right now is squarely in the middle of this political conflict. And Republicans, for a long time now, have kind of sought out information to figure out the extent to which the FBI is engaging in this process in a fair-minded way. This is relatively new in the sense that the FBI has always been assumed to be nonpartisan.
Right, right, right. Has there ever been a period that either of you can recall where the FBI has come under such charges?
I don't recall any specifically regarding the FBI. There have been circumstances where security agencies in one form or another have been called into question for political purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is a rare circumstance. And, you know, the heat is on in Washington right now, as it seems as though Mueller is nearing the end of the investigation.
Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College finishing up this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's get to a couple of other things. Of course, our president leaving the U.S. tonight, arriving tomorrow at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Reports saying he'll meet with the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Swiss president at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He'll meet with Theresa May of Britain, the Prime Minister. Let's Let's listen to this from National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster in a press briefing yesterday. He talked about the meetings slated on the president's schedule for when he arrives in Davos.
The president will use this travel to the World Economic Forum to reiterate his commitment to mutually beneficial partnerships and, as Gary said, to fair and reciprocal international economic systems. As the president has repeatedly said and has made clear in the national security strategy, economic security is national security. The president will also use his time in Davos to discuss other national security issues, including the international effort to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, our coalition to defeat ISIS, our efforts to counter Iran's destructive agenda to perpetuate violence across the greater Middle East, as well as Iran's ballistic missile activity and the fundamental flaws in the Iran nuclear deal.
National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. Wayne, let me turn to you. We have a president elected on a populist message, but in Davos, it's being debated, and that there's a divide between globalists and protectionists. What are you expecting from our president in his speech?
Well, I think that what he will probably is make his America First case and say that the world, in fact, is benefiting from it. The stock market is up. Clearly, many of the people there have huge investments in various things. Their profits are up. He will be at cross purposes with them. As you say, they are multilateralists. He is not a multilateralist. I think what he will try to say is, working with me in bilateral negotiations, you will be able to do well. How persuasive that will be, I am not so sure.
Yet at the same time, Rachel, comment on this. Yesterday, Donald Trump signing into law some steep tariffs on imported solar panels, meant as a move as a way to protect American jobs, but which the solar industry said would lead to thousands of layoffs and raise consumer prices. It turns out that green energy in the U.S. has taken root and has created quite a number of jobs, including here in Iowa, we have to say, Rachel.
That's right. Quite a lot of jobs. And this always happens with a new industry, right? This has been a frequent talking point among Democrats, certainly, that green energy, a move to green energy sources creates jobs in the United States. And it was a push by the Obama administration to do exactly that. So it's not a huge surprise then that we have now a number of jobs associated with those green energy sources. I think, regarding Davos, this is not Donald Trump's typical audience. This is going to be a very awkward interaction, I suspect.
Awkward in what way, do you think?
Well, the theme of this year's meeting at Davos is, creating a shared future in a fractured world. There are a lot of leaders there, business leaders, political leaders, cultural leaders, social leaders, who have very actively opposed the Trump agenda. Trump's base and a lot of his most avid supporters and political advisors have openly disdained this particular crowd of quote unquote globalists. And so it is, this is a moment where we see kind of a clash of cultures and a clash of ideologies, a clash of worldviews with Trump arriving at Davos. So it's going to be, I think, very interesting to track what he says. This is not the first time that he has stepped into an international audience that is not entirely sympathetic to his America First agenda. The extent to which he is able to convey a fundamental sense of what he means by America First to an audience of this kind is going to be really important.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes.
Remember, Trump loves publicity.
Yes.
And he's certainly going to get a great deal of publicity.
Right.
Yes.
Let's talk about this in the remaining 5 minutes. Vice President Pence in Israel, a 4-day trip to the Middle East. Vice President Pence visiting Israel, announcing that the U.S. will advance the plan to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. This is part of his address to the Israeli parliament on Monday.
In the weeks ahead, our administration will advance its plan to open the United States Embassy in Jerusalem. and that United States embassy will open before the end of next year. Our president made his decision in his words, in the best interest of the United States. But he also made it clear that we believe that his decision is in the best interest of peace. By finally recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the United States has chosen fact over fiction. And fact is the only true foundation for a just and lasting peace. Under President Trump, the United States of America remains fully committed to achieve a lasting peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
Vice President Pence before the Israeli parliament on Monday. Wayne, what do you think about those last words? Committed to peace, even though Jerusalem is been seen now by the U.S. as the capital, recognized as the capital of Israel. Palestinians, of course, see East Jerusalem as a capital of their future state. Do you think the Palestinians will be coming back to the negotiating table anytime soon?
No, I think it's almost impossible for the Palestinians, given their views on Jerusalem, will be willing to negotiate at all and willing to rejoin the negotiations. And, of course, also what this commitment does is totally align President Trump with Prime Minister Netanyahu's hardline position and supporting Netanyahu. So I think it's going to be increasingly difficult. It's already very difficult to even envision a two-state solution in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then we'll increasingly raise the question over time of a single solution. And then you get into the issue of rights of the Palestinians within a single state of Israel.
Mm-hmm. The administration saying it's just recognizing what has been the fact of the matter for years. Is there truth to that?
Well, the negotiations haven't been going anywhere, but this makes it impossible, it seems to me, to reopen the negotiations, even if there was a willingness to do so.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, your thoughts looking forward, Rachel and Wayne, in this, the beginning of the second year of President Trump in office. We have an election year, unlike 2017, 2018. Rachel, how does an election year typically shape what gets done or what doesn't get done?
Well, an election year makes it harder to get anything done, partially because, you know, this goes back to the institutional design question. Everybody in Washington is responsible to some constituency. None of them are responsible to exactly the same constituency. And so, you know, they know that their constituents are watching what they're doing right now. They all have very localized interests that they need to represent. It makes it very difficult for them to come together and reach agreement on a lot of issues. Their eyes are on November. And so, you know, I don't expect that we're going to have a terribly productive legislative year, which is not a big surprise, I don't think, to anybody. Having said that, there are a lot of issues on the table right now that the president would like to address and that congressional leaders would like to address. So I suspect it'll be a frustrating year.
Right. Infrastructure, one of those, mm-hmm. that long promised by the president. Rachel, do you see perhaps enough support for doing something there?
Well, infrastructure might be one of the only places where you could find some agreement across the aisle. I think what we're going to see in the next 3 weeks on the budget, on the potential for another government shutdown, on immigration, that's going to set the stage for negotiations and determine whether or not lawmakers are willing to find that agreement on infrastructure and try to move forward. And I don't know the answer to that yet.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, what is your crystal ball say?
One that I'm watching closely that has Iowa implications is what Trump does to NAFTA.
Mm-hmm.
And if NAFTA, if he pulls out of NAFTA, that's going to have really negative implications in terms of the Iowa farm economy. And I think it will be difficult for him in an election year to let NAFTA lapse. My own guess is that he will make some modifications and that NAFTA will continue. And
that if it wasn't an election year, my suspicion is he would pull the he would break the agreement.
He would break the agreement. He has a lot of senators, including our congressmen, our senators here, who well realize the value of NAFTA for Iowa's ag industry, don't they, Rachel?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is again one of those circumstances where I think we're accustomed to a certain way that politics operates and kind of how the president negotiates with Congress on issues like this and considers the interests of those within his party. It'll be interesting to see if President Trump follows those norms and conventions.
Okay. Rachel and Wayne, we are so glad to have your analysis as we continue on our way through this political landscape. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Until next time, thank you, Rachel and Wayne.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Help today from John Pemble as well. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.